Next Friday, as you will see on your notice sheet, we are to hold a quarterly church business meeting for church members. It will be an unusual occasion because, in addition to the business that we normally report on and discuss, at this meeting we shall be deciding upon the appointment of elders and deacons for our church. Now, I can't stress to you enough how important it is that our judgment on that matter is spiritual. If I'm to be frank, I must tell you there's probably no single issue which is more potentially injurious to a church fellowship or hazardous for a church's future than the election of its leadership. Countless examples could be cited from history of churches brought to a state of schism or decline or even rank apostasy because of unwise choices in this matter. And so it seems necessary that before we embark on Friday's business, we give ourselves to a serious and a prayerful study of what the Bible has to say on the qualifications for leadership, so that our minds may be informed by God's wisdom and not our ideas. There are two key passages on this matter. The first is 1 Timothy chapter 3 and the second Titus 1, which we just read from. We began to study these chapters about a month ago. In particular, on that occasion, we discussed the question of family life as it relates to those who should be considered for church office. For you'll see that Paul lays down certain stipulations in these passages regarding, first of all, a leader's marital status, a husband of one wife, the discipline of his children, and the management of his domestic affairs. Now, I hope that at least all the church members here were present on that occasion, and so heard what we had to say about the implications of these passages on those accounts. If you weren't, then the tape is available. We're not going to address ourselves to those issues again this morning. For there are two other broad issues which Paul mentions in connection with the qualifications of a leader in these passages. One is the leader's personal character, and the second is his doctrinal commitment. And my intention is to talk about the first of those this morning, and then at our Wednesday prayer meeting, we should talk about the second, the question of doctrinal orthodoxy in leadership, before we turn to a special time of prayer in preparation for the election on Friday. So let's look at this question of personal character and turn again to the first chapter of Titus, where Paul summarizes it in verses 7 to 8. An overseer, he says, is entrusted with God's work, and so he must be blameless. Not overbearing, not quick-tempered, not given to much wine, not violent, not pursuing dishonest gain. Rather, he must be hospitable, one who loves what is good, who is self-controlled, upright, holy, disciplined. Character, then, that is what Paul is concerned about here, the character of those who stand in public to represent the church. I think we can summarize what he's saying under several headings. You'll find them listed on the church bulletin there, under personal character, if you want to just see where we're going. The first heading I would give you on this subject is that of self-control. There are several words that Paul mentions along those lines in both these passages. In Timothy 3, he talks about the leader being self-controlled and temperate. And then in Titus, he repeats the word self-controlled and provides the additional word disciplined. The leader, then, must be a man who keeps a firm watch on his own behavior and attitudes. That's what Paul is saying. The word self-controlled literally means having a sound mind. It describes the man whose judgment is never swayed by passion or whim, a man whose sense of responsibility can always be relied upon, a man of discretion. The word disciplined, on the other hand, which occurs in the Titus 1 passage, is usually related to the physical rather than the mental realm. It's the word, for instance, that Paul uses to describe the physical training which an athlete engages in when he's preparing for competition. And it's also often used in the New Testament to mean sexual chastity. So that describes a man whose body is kept under tight moral control. And that word temperate, which we find in the Timothy passage, That in some ways a bridge between these other two words, because it's often employed as the opposite of drunken. It implies both a sobriety of mind and a moderation of appetite. And this particular aspect of self-control, of course, is one which Paul specifies repeatedly in both passages, doesn't he? Not given to much wine, he says, both of elders and deacons, and repeats it again in Titus 1. Of course, alcohol was very commonly consumed in the first century society, both Roman and Greek and Jewish society. It was regarded there, I suppose, pretty much as we would regard tea or coffee. And as a result of that, the embarrassment which intoxication causes and the vicious bondage of alcoholism were well known in those societies. I want you to notice that Paul does not insist that church leaders should be teetotalers. Total abstention wasn't a completely crazy idea, for Jews had long been familiar with it as part of the Nazarite vow. But Paul doesn't require such a vow of church leaders. Indeed, it would probably have been very socially eccentric if he had done in that social milieu in which he was placed. What Paul does require is abstemiousness in this matter. They shall be self-controlled in the way that they use alcohol. That's his requirement. And of course, the same is required of church officers today. It would be quite wrong to think that a bottle of Beaujolais in the cupboard for a special occasion excluded a man from church office. On the other hand, a conviction for drunken driving certainly should. This general heading of self-control embraces another aspect of Paul's inventory of character too. You notice that he speaks in both passages of control of the temper. Not violent, he says. Not quarrelsome. And again in Titus, he adds the additional phrases. Not quick-tempered. Not overbearing. For you see, there are many men who, whilst they may be very high-principled, very theologically sound, are nevertheless victim to a belligerence of temperament that renders them quite useless as leaders. We said last time we looked at these passages that leadership in the New Testament church is always plural. Paul speaks of elders, deacons. There were no monarchical bishops sitting on their episcopal thrones. There were no monarchical pastors standing 6 foot above contradiction in their infallible pulpits. New Testament church ministry was always team ministry. And therefore the ability to get along and work in a team is absolutely vital to the task. Is he the sort of man, Paul is suggesting by these words, who can be criticized without going red in the face or flying off the handle? Is he naturally argumentative, always having a row with somebody? Does he tend to get on a high horse over minor issues? Is he one of those people that always has to be right? Does he tend to push his point of view so forcibly nobody else dares to contradict him? To use the positive word that Paul selects in 1 Timothy 3, is he gentle? You see that in verse 3? Not violent, but gentle. It's a very beautiful word, although it's almost untranslatable into English, unfortunately. The best way to explain the meaning of that word, I think, is to tell you how the philosopher Aristotle defined it in his great work on ethics. He said that the gentle man, the word Paul uses here, is a man who is more than just. He said that sometimes, when you're involved in the law, the legally right thing to do, just because the law has to embrace all possible situations, the legally right thing to do is not necessarily the fairest thing. He said, a gentleman is a man who knows when to wave his legal rights aside in the cause of fair play. In other words, we might say, he's a man who can meet his opponent halfway. It embraces forbearance and humility and graciousness and cordiality. Perhaps the nearest equivalent in colloquial English that we can find to this word gentle is easygoing. Yes, says Paul, is he easygoing in the best sense of the word? And the root of that, he says, is control of the temper, not quarrelsome, not violent. Paul's advice on this matter is absolutely vital. Because if we want harmonious leadership in the church, we have to choose men who can keep their cool. men who are flexible enough and charitable enough to shake their opponent's hand rather than black his eye. Self-control. Yes, and one other area of behavior which Paul mentions that could be included under that general title. Self-controlled in the use of the tongue also. Two things are involved here. Do you notice in verse 8 of 1 Timothy 3, Paul uses the word sincere. Literally, that word is not double-speeched. A man who isn't fork-tongued, if you like. A man who doesn't adjust what he says to suit his hearer. There must be integrity about a leader's words, says Paul. He must have the moral courage to tell the truth, even if it's going to be an embarrassment to his own ego, even though it may not be popular to those who hear. He must not be one of those men who gives a different story to different people because it's convenient to do so. Truthfulness. But more than truthfulness, Paul also requires, in this matter of control of the tongue, kindness. You see that in verse 11. Not malicious talkers. Literally, again, what Paul says there is not devils. For the Greek word devil, strictly speaking, means a slanderer. That's what the devil is, of course. He's the one who gains spiteful satisfaction from exposing the moral weaknesses of men. As a self-appointed prosecuting counsel, he makes it his business to accuse us before God's bar of justice, and he's never more delighted than when he wins his case. And unfortunately, there are people who share the devil's taste in scandal and defamation of character. And I want you to notice whom Paul identifies as the chief culprits in that regard. For verse 11 is directed to their wives. Now, there is an ambiguity there. What Paul actually says is simply women. And the word woman in Greek can mean just a woman or a wife. So some commentators and our translation here take it to mean the wives of the deacons. And if so, that would imply that in assessing a man's qualifications for office, some attention must be paid to the character of his spouse. A piece of advice which I judge to be wise, even if it's not Paul's meaning here. But I think if Paul had meant the wives of the deacons in verse 11, he would have said in the Greek, their women, and not just women. And in the absence of that possessive pronoun, I think it's most likely that Paul is speaking rather about female office bearers in the church, which the margin of our translation calls deaconesses. There's fairly good evidence that such appointments were made in the early church. And in fact, the parallel in the structure of the passage here between verse 8 and verse 11, where Paul says, likewise deacons, and using exactly the same expression, likewise women, suggests that he's talking about a different group of church officers here. The female deacons, if you like, the women who were appointed to certain offices within the church. As we said a few Sundays ago when we were talking about the role of women in church leadership, what Paul says in this book, at the end of chapter 2, about a woman not being permitted to teach, only excludes her from the office of elder, does not exclude her from that area of service in the church which doesn't imply authority, and particularly authority over men. Either way, then, whether Paul is talking about the deaconesses or the wives of the deacons, it is the ladies to whom he's addressing here. Paul is speaking to them specifically when he warns about the danger of slander, not malicious talkers. I can't tell you. In fact, I fear only the day of judgment will reveal how much evil has been generated in the Church of Jesus Christ simply by gossip. And it surely cannot be a coincidence that in every language of the world in which nouns are given gender, the word tongue is expressed in the feminine. Now, you can call me a male chauvinist if you wish, but I think experience confirms what I say to be true, and more important than that, the apostle confirms it too. Self-control, then, That is the first qualification under this general category of personal character, which Paul lays down. Control of the mind. He must be a man whose discretion can be relied upon, who doesn't fly off on wild ideas, who's got sound judgment. Control of the body. He must be a disciplined person, sexually, physically, in every way. He must be a man who doesn't give way to passion or appetite. In the use he makes of alcohol, in the use he makes of his tongue, and his temper, in all these ways, he must be a self-controlled man. But there are two other areas, too, which Paul specifies in these passages relating to personal character. Let's go on to those. The second is money and material possessions. Once again, this is mentioned in several times and with several connotations in the passage. For instance, Paul says here that generosity ought to be seen in the lives of those who are appointed leaders. It's enjoined in that word hospitality that he uses in both passages. Literally, the word means loving the stranger. And as such, of course, it's got a peculiar relevance to us at Cambridge at this time of the year. Now, I don't know if you remember seeing those T-shirts that were brazened around the place last year. I am not a tourist, I live here. I suppose you can't blame the Cambridge inhabitants from getting a bit bitter and twisted when they find they can't get into their own shops and car parks during the summer. But there's nothing Christian, you know, about such resentment, such parochialism. From its very beginning, the early church gave evidence of its desire to break down the cultural prejudices that divide men by offering hospitality to brother and sister Christians wherever they came from in the world. Indeed, it became one of the cardinal Christian virtues and greatly influenced the monastic movement in the Middle Ages, of course. It may have been overemphasized, but still Paul's point here is one that must be taken to heart by all of us, even today, when hotels and guest houses are more in evidence than they were in the first century. The willingness to share our homes is an important indication of that generosity of spirit that ought to characterize the Christian community. If we have spare room in our homes, it should be used. It is selfish if it is not. And it isn't sufficient excuse to simply say, well, we keep that room for the family when they come once a week every year. And church leaders, says Paul, are expected to set an example in this open-handed liberality towards visitors. Another matter under this general heading of the use we make of material possessions is honesty. In verse 8, you find that in the Timothy reference. Not pursuing dishonest gain, he says. And Paul repeats the same requirement in verse 7 of the Titus reference. But you see, elders and deacons are in a position of trust in the church. They often have access to church funds and church property. It only takes one incidence of petty theft to destroy the credibility of the leadership in the eyes of church members and to destroy the credibility of the church in the eyes of the general public. So a man's honesty, says Paul, must be absolutely impeccable if he's to hold office. And of course, the obvious way to assess that is to look at his own business dealings. If he's a man who goes in for shady deals and sharp practice, and he's the type who's always discovering boxes that have mysteriously fallen off the back of lorries, then it is unlikely he's going to command the necessary trust or ought to. He must be honest. But the third thing which Paul says under this general heading of money, he must be content, too. Look at verse 3. Not a lover of money, says Paul. For you see, a man can be generous and honest and still be thoroughly materialistic. There are two mistakes that it's possible to make in regard to affluence. The one is to surrender to it, to centre our lives, as everybody else does, around the pursuit of status symbols and luxury goods, to measure our success in terms of the size of our house, the quality of our cars, the expensiveness of our clothes, and so on. The other is to react against affluence, to make a virtue of asceticism, the simple lifestyle. As if this were somehow more authentically Christian. No car, no television, no washing machine, no carpets. It is difficult to know where one does draw the line. Both those extremes are wrong. The first, because it idolizes God's creation. And the second, because it denies God's creation. Paul, in fact, sets a very important balance on this question in the letter to Timothy. He says, on the one hand, in chapter 4, verse 4, everything created by God is good, and nothing is to be rejected if it's received with thanksgiving. There he's writing specifically against super-spiritual self-denial. But then in chapter 6, he warns of the opposite danger. People who want to get rich, he says, fall into temptation. If we have food and clothing, we shall be content with that. So he warns on the one hand, you see, of self-denial, on the other hand, of materialistic greed. The key word is that word, contentment. We shall be content with that. Well, you see, the key issue on this question is not the quantity of wealth which a man has. It is the attitude of heart which he adopts towards that wealth, or indeed towards the lack of it. Paul does not say money is the root of all evil, though he's often misquoted to that effect. He says the love of money is the root of all evil. And you see, the point about the love of money is that it's a passion that can grip the heart of the rich and the poor alike. Love of money has nothing to do with what we've got. It has everything to do with what we want. It's not a function of a man's possessions, it's a function of a man's priorities in life. And the Christian virtue is neither to admire money nor to despise it. The Christian virtue is to be content with what we have. And that really is what Paul is demanding here in 1 Timothy 3, when he says an elder must not be a lover of money. It does not mean that our elders must live in the cheapest possible accommodation and eat the cheapest possible food and wear the cheapest possible clothes. That isn't an elder, that is a monk. Some religions may admire such self-mortification. Christianity is not one of them. No, as far as money goes, Christian character demands three things. It demands generosity, honesty, and contentment. And we have no grounds to inquire beyond that in our examination of a candidate's financial affairs. But there is one third issue which we must talk about in this area of character before we close. We've talked about self-control. We've talked about the man's attitude to his material possessions. Spiritual maturity is the third. And though Paul only mentions it once, he mentions it quite clearly, and we must not forget it. Verse 6. He must not be a recent convert. Now, it's very instructive to note why Paul says maturity is important. Because it's not, as you might expect, a question of lack of experience or biblical knowledge. This is often what is in people's minds when they say, oh no, we can't appoint him, he's too young. They have some idea there is a certain amount of experience or biblical information that a man has got to be the master of before he could possibly be considered. Well, there's a measure of truth in that. But Paul's main concern is not the usefulness of the candidate, but the maturity of the candidate. His main concern, you see, is the spiritual danger into which election to office can so easily lead a young Christian. Because, he says, he may become conceited and fall under the same judgment as the devil. Now that verse could mean three things. It could mean, as our translation takes it, that just as the devil fell from angelic bliss because of his arrogant self-assertion, so an elder in the church, if the office goes to his head, can be similarly spiritually ruined. Alternatively, it could mean that a man's conceit forms a bridgehead into his own personality, into on which the devil can build, and so bring the man into God's condemnation. Or just possibly, it may mean a third thing. Paul may be using that word devil, as we mentioned before, simply to mean a slanderer, in which case the text means that a conceited elder plays into the hands of those malicious gossips in the church who enjoy picking holes in the leadership. Whatever precisely the sense is, the main lesson is clear. The first response of any man, when he's told he's been nominated for church office, and I don't care who he is, this is always the first response we have, it is a flush of pride. We are flattered to have been asked. We wouldn't be human if we didn't feel that. But if we do, if we dare not let that tendency, that inclination to vanity, take root in our hearts. Because if we do, it will jeopardize our whole ministry. Do not recall when we were looking in our very first study on the issue of leadership in Mark chapter 10, Christ's primary character requirement for leadership. It wasn't self-control, you remember. It wasn't self-denial, even. It was self-effacement, humility. The rulers of the Gentiles lorded over them, not so among you, he said. Whoever would be great among you must be your servant. Whoever would be first among you must be slave of all, even as I, the Son of Man, did not come to be served, but to serve. Give my life a ransom for many. Of course, humility isn't easy. You can't achieve it, you can't put it on, you can't even observe it in your own character, because once you do, you immediately destroy it by self-congratulation. Now, humility is one of those things which is the fruit of a renewed personality. It's the evidence of a mind that is being molded into the likeness of Christ. And such unself-conscious virtue does not come quickly. It cannot. New converts are not infrequently the most bumptious and self-confident of people. Don't we all cringe, remember some of the things we said and did when we were young Christians? Oh, we knew all the answers. We didn't need to be told a thing. We could see all the mistakes in the church very clearly, couldn't we? Boy, oh boy, what a revolution we were going to cause. It took time and not a few humiliations before the Lord had purged that haughtiness out of our manner, and even longer before we purged it out of our secret hearts. Well, let's be quite clear about this. It's important. Paul is not saying you mustn't appoint a young man to office. In that sense, the word elder is misleading. But whilst it does imply seniority, it doesn't necessarily have reference to age. For Timothy, to whom Paul is writing here, was most certainly a young man by Middle Eastern standards. Yet it's quite clear that Paul placed him in a position of spiritual authority over many who were older than he was. He even has to say to him, don't let anybody look down on you because you are young. Now, Paul is not saying that all our church officers must be old men. He is saying they must all be spiritually mature men. The young convert is unsuitable, not because he's young, but because Christian character isn't produced overnight. And Christian character is what a man must have if he's to lead the Church of Christ. So here are the two main planks of Paul's list of leadership qualifications: the man's family life, the man's personal character, self-control, attitude to money, spiritual maturity. Why is it that these areas of things are so critical? Why is it that Paul talks about these things rather than anything else when he lays down qualifications for office? We could perhaps think of various reasons why that might be. The importance that the leader should offer a good example, for instance, if his leadership is not to suffer from a credibility gap. The special temptations which come to church officers, like pride or financial gain that we've considered today. But I want you to notice just finally that the primary reason Paul cites throughout these passages why a man's family life and personal character are paramount in our assessment of his suitability is not because of any of those things, but rather because it is a man's family life and character which the world outside can observe. Look at verse 7 of 1 Timothy 3. He must have a good reputation with outsiders, so that he will not fall into disgrace and into the devil's trap. And this emphasis on unimpeachability of church office comes out again and again and again. He must be above reproach. He must be respectable. He must be blameless, says Paul. Because you see, although the church doesn't belong to the world, the church's ministry is to serve and transform the world. The church is the yeast of the kingdom, distributed through the dough of the world. It's the salt of the earth, the light of the world. The church is involved in a cosmic warfare. We must never forget that. A battle for world control. Like paratroopers dropped behind enemy lines, the church has been set in the middle of the satanic realm. The realm, the kingdom of darkness. And it is there to capture that darkness in the name of her legitimate king, King Jesus. And because we're involved in that cosmic conflict with Satan, he will always be on the lookout to discredit the church, to trap her in some way. Now, the world may think the church's gospel message is unpalatable. She may think it's old-fashioned or ridiculous even. It's the task of Christian apologetics to try and reduce that barrier of prejudice, but in a sense it probably can't be helped. The world will always think that what Christians say and believe is a little odd. But whatever the world thinks of the gospel, Paul is determined that the world shall always respect the church. Even if our gospel becomes the object of men's contempt, Christian character must always be respected. Otherwise, how can she fulfill her evangelistic function? Salt which has lost its taste, says Jesus, is good for nothing. Men throw it out, tread it under their feet. Paul is concerned that the church must be respected, even if its message is not understood or liked. And the primary key to that respect in the world is the moral stature and reputation of the church's leadership. We must have men, says Paul, in office in the church who command the world's respect, who have a good reputation. Otherwise, the devil will have all the opportunity he wants to destroy both them and the work of the church and bring us all into disgrace. I say, it's impossible to emphasize these things too strongly. But all too often, in the history of the church, disaster has been brought about because we haven't paid attention to what the apostle says here and have let our decision on these matters be controlled by other things. For a long period of church history, church leaders were appointed by political patronage. The disasters that were caused, the shame and disgrace that was brought upon the church in the Middle Ages as a result of priests and bishops and even popes whose character was repulsive to the scriptures, has only got to be read to realize what damage he did. The very Protestant Reformation was the fruit of that abuse. But even in Protestant Reformed churches like ours, other factors are often what actually control our choice in the matter of officers, and not what Paul says here. Often, for instance, popularity is what controls our choices. Oh, yes, of course I'll vote for him. He's such a nice fella. Oh no, I can't vote for him, can't stand him. As if the church were a fan club. Sometimes ability controls our choices. Oh yes, he's good at public speaking, we ought to appoint him. He's an accountant, oh yes, he's the ideal man for deacon. Oh yes, we should appoint him, he's got a lot of qualifications, a lot of letters after his name. But Paul puts very little emphasis on gifts here. Oh, he mentions some. The ability to teach for an elder. Competence in managing domestic affairs for a deacon, yes. Gifts are not unimportant, but they are not his primary thrust. Perhaps most dangerous of all in the church is the influence of friendship or even of family connections. Elections all too often become a battleground for rival interests in a church, not to say rival clans within a church, each seeking to extend their own influence by getting their man in. And the havoc to which such favoritism leads is awful to behold. It was the very mistake which Paul had to rebuke in Corinth. I am of Apollos, I am of Peter, I am of Paul, they were saying, as if church government were an exercise in party politics. Now, church officers are not representatives of different power blocks within the congregation. Their class background, their family connections, their friendships, their personal opinions even, their academic qualifications, such things are irrelevant to their suitability. And to allow our vote to be controlled by them is to invite schism and misery with open arms. Now, Paul is saying here the primary issue is a man's family life and personal character. Whether you like him or not, whether you know him well or not, whether you're related to him or not, have nothing to do with it. Look at these issues. The self-discipline of the man. The man's attitude of money. The man's spiritual maturity. The way he runs his family. Yes, and look at his doctrinal commitment too. When you have assessed those things, and only those things, then you're in a position to vote. Let's pray together.